Then we will acquire after LOI 2 at 80 hours, 40 minutes, 7 seconds. That's 80, 40, 07. And without the LOI 2 burn, our acquisition would be 80, 39, 06. Now, if I haven't gotten the parameters, any that you're interested in, like velocities, see me after this thing, and maybe we can we'll call over and get you an answer.
Arthur Hill.
If some transitory problem prevented the crew from performing LOI 1 at the time indicated, but the problem got solved so that while they were still behind the moon, they could perform the maneuver on a second try, would they do so?
You're talking about an ignition that didn't occur, Art?
Right.
No, we've got to do that burn where we've got it scheduled. Now, granted, we could slip it a little ways and a few seconds. If there was an initial problem right at ignition, he could slip it maybe 10, 15 seconds. But if he hadn't got the problem finished by then, he'll come on out.
Can you tell us about the onboard navigation today? What is the condition of the state vector generated in the spacecraft? And what about the efficacy of using the Earth horizon? I gather that Young, on the first day, had no trouble using 24 kilometers for the blue line. On the second day, he did have trouble. What is his experience today?
Well, the only P-23 sightings he did today were the Trunnion.
We didn't do any
orbital navigation today.
It was not scheduled as a flight plan, just a Trunnion calibration. The MIT people and our systems experts felt that the difference was due to a Trunnion bias in his sightings. However, we ran that through, and it was not the Trunnion bias. We didn't see a state vector on the ground. We did not get a dump. We uplinked a MISFEN state vector this afternoon at about 52 hours.
And that was just because it was scheduled there. There was no, at least I can tell you, that there was no gross deterioration of the state vector. It may have been off a little bit, but we updated it per the flight plan.
Yes, well, yesterday at the press conference, the onboard state vector was about 3 miles off at Earth return perigee, off the ground-generated vector, and I wondered if that differential had changed any.
I suspect, and I didn't read the transcript, I suspect that may have been the result of incorporating marks during the P-23. Now, today we didn't do any incorporation of those marks, and I really don't know what the error was at the return to Earth point. We can find out for you.
Right there.
Is this the first time you had automatic star tracking on the guidance?
Negative. We've done that in all the missions. The auto optics routine you're talking about, where you actually let the optics drive by the computer. No, we've done that on all the Apollo missions.
Just move on over there.
Because of the extremely accurate marks you're getting, are you looking at all toward relying solely on the GNN during some upcoming missions? I'm talking about 13 and 14. Do you think you'll ever get to the point where
we'll always have a vote with the ground and the spacecraft merely because we have the opportunity to do it. And I don't think we would throw away one of those votes just for the heck of it. Now, obviously, there are certain cases even now where we have to rely on spacecraft guidance, and it is a very reliable system. It's worked great. Of course, we've gone to that procedure for the launch phase abort logic. We're letting the onboard system be the one that gets us into orbit. So, no, I don't think we'll ever completely throw away just to turn the machines down here on the ground, no.
Well, is it possible that the onboard system will ever be more accurate than, during the currently planned Apollo series than ground tracking?
I suppose it's possible. We have no big hardware changes proposed, though, so I assume we're going to have to live with the hardware capabilities that we have now, and there's certain biases and drifts and all that are in that that we'll probably live with for Apollo anyway.
Well, let me ask it this way, then. Is the limiting factor in the accuracy of the GNN hardware or software situation, or is it the experience and operating capability?
It's all three of those. Certainly, if we had a larger computer, we could probably go one finer step level of accuracy in software. State-of-the-art, of course, will improve on hardware. And, of course, as you have a crew that gets more and more experience, he's going to be able to do it better. So all three of those make a better accuracy.
We'll move on over.
I'm not sure who can answer this, but I'll ask it anyway. Last night at 9:30, each member of the crew took Lomotil. Would anybody care to comment on that?
Dr. Berry will comment on that when he comes over in an hour or so. He's the guy to ask. We're not aware of right now.
During the color TV shows, why does the sky look blue out the windows instead of black?
I don't know. I guess that's a good question. I guess the color reproduction there is just not exact. I know no reason for it.
I don't either. Yesterday it looked black to me. Today I did notice a bluish tinge, though, to it, and it might have to do with our color processor. I might be getting into an area that I don't know that much about, but as I understand the system, the signal today was received at Goldstone, sent to Houston, and we have a color processor over in the Building 8 here at the site, and it's then processed into color and sent over to us and then out to the networks. And whether there was something in that or just something in the camera, I don't know, but I did notice a bluish tinge to it, too.
Has there been any identification of the two objects which were seen yesterday, one fairly bright rotating object and another smaller one?
No. In fact, we had some problems on the ground here. I never did quite get squared away exactly what our problem was. We were going to try to come up with some shaft and trunnion angles for the S4B so that they might look through the optics to make sure that this object they had reported earlier was the S4B. We never did get around to that for one reason or another. It kept slipping off, and we finally just didn't do it. And to my knowledge, no. Yet, we're not quite sure what he's seen. It's likely the S4B, I assume, but we don't know that.
And what about the present status of this oxidizer pressure in the SPS?
The SPS or the command module, RCS?
Well,
let me answer the SPS. There had been, I guess, a...
Yesterday there was some problem with SPS oxidizer,
yes.
Whether it was a gauge error or whether he was really seeing a soft...
Yes, that phenomenon had been seen on previous missions, incidentally. It's after a burn, the pressure tends to go up because of the large slug of helium you've thrown into the tank, and it shut down. There's some overshoot there. And then the pressure tends to go down as the helium is absorbed by the propellant, or propellants, in this case the oxidizer. And as more of that helium comes out of gas and goes into solution, you decrease the pressure, of course. And that's what was seen. There was about a 3 or 4 PSI drop, I think, something on that order, after the burn. And we're happy that's a normal. Now, that situation is much more pronounced when you have almost full tanks. As the tanks get emptier and you have more empty, I guess I should say, and you have more helium in there, then the effect won't be noticed because there won't be as much absorption percentage-wise by the oxidizer.
You mentioned RCS. There was some talk in the transcript earlier about a question of RCS pressurization. What is the status of that?
Those are holding fine, doing exactly what we'd expected them to do. We're satisfied that the system's tight and that we're going all right. Ring A, the last time I looked, I think, was 37 PSI in the manifold. I think ring B was, ring 2 was 35. So... We're satisfied with that situation.
Get a microphone over here, please. Well, one of you go over there and want the other one to stay over here.
What is the prevailing theory of why bubbles go to the bottom of the bag?
Wish we could answer that one.
Is there any thinking on it at all?
If you'd have seen the scent standing in the control center with Charlie with a bag spinning around and around, you would know our problem.
I assume in the control center the bubbles go to the top, right?
As you would expect, gas rises. If you fill a bottle up with a faucet in 1G, the bubbles rise. But we don't have the answer for that. We feel like the surface tension of the liquid against the bag might be an explanation that you just can't generate enough radial G's on the bag to make it come to the top.
And this quivering or shuddering, could anyone elaborate on why that might be occurring, and the noise?
Well, the noise is pretty explainable. You got pumps and all.
But the quivering sounds like, could it have anything to do with the temperature variations from cold to hot on the outside?
I suppose it could, but
I think the biggest problem is we have the ascent tanks on the limb are half full, and we might have some fuel sloshing in those tanks.
Tom mentioned that.
And that could give us as it bumps up against one side, if it's going as a mass, could give you that quivering.
One other thing, what did Cernan write to his wife that would cause her to cry?
I have no idea. I guess that was a personal letter.
She said she cried. Did anyone ask her why?
No, I didn't. I talked to her on the telephone, and it wasn't any of my business.
Right there.
You said earlier on lunar insertion that there should be a burn time of 5 minutes, 53.8 seconds. What is the safety margin here if the rocket doesn't shut down? How many minutes can it burn safely?
Well, there's a way they can get it shut down. Now, in their monitoring, they have an overburn limit, and I think it's 2 seconds, isn't it, for LOI-1. They can go, there's two switches that they can throw in the cockpit, and the engine's going to shut down. There's no doubt about that. So what they do is they actually control that situation. If they don't get an auto shutdown, then they'll shut the engine down manually.
So they have a 2-second margin, and if they exceed that, then they would crash onto the moon.
No, 2 seconds wouldn't be enough to do it. It'd take more than that, but 2 seconds is way safe. As you can see, the second burn is on the order of 13, 14 seconds to get you to a 60-mile circular, and it's done essentially at the same place in the orbit. So even with a burn on the order of 13 or 14 seconds, you're only going to, over LOI-1, you're going to be on the order of 60 circular. So we're shutting it off well prior to that time.
Mark Bloom.
Do you have an explanation for why tripling the roll rate in the PTC mode seems to have solved your problems with the dead band?
Well, the dynamics of the thing, I assume, as you get the roll rate a little higher, I'd think that your angular momentum or your momentum vector is going to be more stabilized now.
It's more like a gyroscope then.
That's
a
high-speed
gyroscope.
That's right.
I think we were probably in a little bit. We had a lot more stable vehicle when we started the roll rate too than the first night when we attempted it. That also has a lot to do with it. Any small rate that you start with, other than in roll, will couple right in, and you start spiraling out. And this might have something to do with our problem the first night.
Mark, go ahead. Am I right in assuming that there is an automatic sequence of events which will fire the service module engine for LOI, but that an enabling button must be pushed 5 seconds before?
That's right.
And that button must be pushed between 5 seconds and zero?
That's right.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I have a few questions. One, is any data being sent by telemetry to the ground from the LEM at this point? Is it live in any way?
No. The only thing that we've got on the LEM is a CSM measurement, is the, we've actually got two, and the other one's a CSM too. We have the current that's being supplied to the LEM heaters, that we can monitor, and that's on CSM telemetry. We also have a gauge that shows the delta pressure between the CSM and the limb tunnel and the limb interior. So we can measure, essentially we can measure the temperature, and we can measure we can measure the pressure in the limb, and we can measure the current being supplied to the heaters. That's all.
The second question is, can you explain the use of the word couple? I see it in the transcript all the time.
Couple into yaw or something
like
that?
Yeah, this couples in with that attitude rate or something. What is
it? It means it just, let me see how I could say that. It couples, but
let me try. It actually
diverges.
The proper term is cross couples. You take three axes of rotation, and as you start rotating around one axis, the cross products of inertia, which are, I won't attempt to explain, but the momentum vector is around one axis, and if the thing is not perfectly symmetrical, such as a cylinder, then as you start rotating around, you pick up rotations in the other axes, and that when we say couple, we just mean the rotation about this axis couples into a rotation about this axis, so the thing starts doing this.
Fine, now I understand. And one question phoned to me from New York, which I don't really understand. Perhaps you will. Will the TV be on tomorrow at approximately 72 hours, 48 minutes, which I think is 10 minutes after regularly scheduled, to catch a relatively significant event, which is the spacecraft passing into the umbra? At that point, they'll be able to take pictures of the corona of the sun, I suppose. Does that mean anything to you gentlemen?
Yes, and the answer to your question is that's approximately correct. 72 hours and 20 minutes is what we have in the flight plan, and they are going to leave that on until they do enter the limb umbra, the lunar umbra. Although it doesn't, the flight plan doesn't quite show it that way. Tom said before liftoff that he intended to try to see the sunset. So I imagine it will get it on somewhere around 72:20, and if it's like the other TV passes that we've had, he's been getting on a little earlier than that, and he'll try to track the sun as it goes behind the moon.
This has probably been asked before, but can someone explain to me why it isn't possible to perform an LOI burn which would put the spacecraft straight into a circular orbit?
You could.
If you could, why don't you?
It's a two-step process. It's a safer. The overburn situation is not as critical for one thing. We're leaving ourselves enough margin here that we can do a very long burn and get a shutdown and find out exactly where we are, and then we can update that second maneuver to a precise shorter burn to get us down to 60 circular. But it could be done with a single burn. In fact, that was considered for a long time, and this two-step plan was one of the options that we finally decided to go with.
Do you plan to, after you go into lunar orbit, fire the LEM radar at all before you detach and go down to 8 nautical miles?
The landing radar or the...
Yes, the landing
radar. Prior to undocking, we will have a rendezvous radar checkout. After undocking and the CSM separation performs a separation maneuver, then the rendezvous radar will be locked on to the CSM for a checkout of it as far as range rate readout goes. And prior to DOI, we will activate the landing radar with a self-test. We will have it on for the DOI burn just to measure temperature on the antenna. And then we will have a landing radar test in the flight plan scheduled at 8 miles when they go over the Paracentian.
What type of accuracy is projected for the landing radar at 50,000 feet?
I don't know.
I can't give you an exact figure for that. There have been some studies, and if I can dredge this up, it was... At 50,000 feet, when it does lock on, we expect it to indicate 8,000 feet too low in altitude, and there's a number for that we can come up with for velocity. And we'll those numbers are available, and we can supply those to you, I'm sure. There's been an analysis done on that.
Thank you.
Would you please let me know the size and volume of the water bag?
It's a 4-pound bag. It'll hold 4 pounds of water, which is approximately 2 quarts, half a gallon.
And the size, length, yes.
It's about this long and about that wide.
Don't you know the exact number of the probably 60 inches?
I beg your pardon? The exact length?
Exact number of the inches or feet?
I would estimate 16 inches, but we can determine that for you and supply that information to you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just a quickie. Have you sorted out why the hydrogen bubble remains in the bottom of the bag yet?
No. We tried to answer that one earlier, and nobody knows.
Do we have another one over here while we're waiting? Right, let's get this gentleman's question, then we'll get the one over there.
Just to clarify on this landing radar, I take it we shouldn't be too upset when we hear a figure of 42,000 feet, right?
We'll have to check my numbers on that, but something of that order is correct. The radar is designed to lock in at about 35,000 feet, and so we're stretching the margin, but it's the only test we're going to get, so we'd like to run what we can and get what we can out of it.
Some or one of us anyway would like to go eat after this. Can we be fairly sure that the Barry briefing will not begin before 9 o'clock?
No, sir. He'll come over as soon as possible, and we couldn't guarantee you that it will not be before 9. Okay, I'd suggest that on the questions about the landing radar, I think you'll be able to get the answers from the query desk in the news center. If they don't already have them, we'll make sure that they will be available over there.
And you can also get the size of that water bag, too.
Yes, and the other questions that were asked.
Oh, it's about like this.
Thank you, sir.
Dick Mettower, will you please come up on cord?
The flight of Apollo 10. The spacecraft now at a range of 179,455 nautical miles from Earth, and the speed is 3,314 feet per second. During the change of shift press conference, we had one brief conversation with the crew. John Young advised that he can now see both the Earth and the Moon from the windows of the spacecraft. He reported that the Moon looked to be about the same size as the Earth at this time, but that all they could see was just a sliver of lighted portion. We'll play back that conversation for you now.
Houston, Apollo 10.
10 is Houston. Go ahead.
Roger. Does that seem about right to you all?
That looks right about right from the little Earth-Moon transit graph we've got. They should look about the same to you. Can you feel them pulling about the same?
Now we feel the Moon pulling just a little bit harder right now, Joe.
Okay, something's wrong.
You're saying we're not in the lunar sphere yet?
Not quite.
You forgot we can pull from here, too.
Okay. You guys are really slowing down out there. You don't want to stall it out now.
I guess we're just barely chugging along here. What's the stall speed of this one, Joe?
I'm not real sure. I'll check that out. Just push your nose over when you feel it burble.
All right. You're getting close to that burble.
Bomber 10, Houston.
Go ahead, Houston. Bomber
10. Tom, we'd like to switch your hydrogen around a little bit. Let's go to the sleep configuration. Tank one to auto and tank two off.
Tank one heater to auto, tank two off.
That's perfect.
That brings us up to date with all of the conversation that developed during the change of shift briefing. The capsule communicator on this shift is astronaut Joe Engel. At 55 hours, 59 minutes into the flight of Apollo 10, this is Mission Control, Houston.